Today's podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. I'm going to shout out some of my patrons, give them some love, give you the rules for the podcast, and we're going to be well on our way, ladies and gentlemen. First and foremost, I want to shout out some of my patrons, my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new investor day trader service. If you're a day trader, it's got an infinite number of tools for you. It has investor education. It has daily watch lists. It has a live stream to follow with my buddy Pete and his entire team of traders as they navigate their way through the markets on a daily basis. They're looking for opportunities in equities. They're looking for opportunities in options. They're looking for opportunities in green markets and in red markets. The only thing they're not looking for is garbage. They don't mess with low floaters. They don't mess with fraud. They don't waste their time. And Pete started his service to compete with other services that he knew were kind of pumping, well, bullshit and doing things that were, I don't want to say nefarious, but that investor services probably shouldn't be doing. So Pete said, I'm going to step out and do things the right way, which is why I'm very happy to recommend Pete and the Trader's Path. There's a link in the podcast description if you're a day trader worth checking out, definitely. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. The folks over at the Sanglucci Steam Room do a couple of things. First and foremost, the Steam Room is a place where you can check in daily and get live updates on big money coming into the options market. Why do these guys follow money into the options market and flow coming into the options market? Well, usually it can precede many times, not always, but oftentimes it precedes where an equity is going to go. So the options markets are illiquid enough for Lucci and his band of traders who have a proprietary way of measuring money flow coming into options to take a look at what's going on and help them direct their trading. It's a strategy that they are some of the originators of. They were doing it before all these other investor services were doing it. They've been doing it for almost a decade now. They're experts in it. I know Sanglucci and his partner, Charlie Bathgate, personally. I trust them. They're friends of mine. They're good guys. And in addition to that, if you're not interested in the Steam Room, Lucci offers a couple other things. One, he's got the Sanglucci Master Course. Okay, so you're going to get investor education. You're going to get market psychology. You're going to get tape reading. All the tactics they use on a daily basis for their trading, that's available in the podcast description. And also the 3LT playbook, which is Lucci's three simple rules. Not a lot to remember, folks. One, two, three rules for how he became a seven-figure trader. I've seen the account balances. He has paid off the bar tabs for me. He parties in Puerto Rico. Check out my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. The folks over at Rumorhound are huge supporters of the podcast, and I am huge fans of theirs. What is Rumorhound? If you go to their website, rumorhound.ai, you will see Rumorhound is a brand new tool that uses artificial intelligence to check out basically all of the rumors of mergers and acquisitions that come across the wire on a daily basis. Right before I started doing this podcast, there was one that came up for FCX, which I think is Freeport MacMoran, but I can't even remember. But anyways, rumor came across for FCX. What is Rumorhound going to do for you? It's going to take these rumors, whether they're in chat rooms, whether you see them on the news, and it's going to use artificial intelligence to look at many different variables, only some of which are the financial position of that the companies are in, the credibility of the sources that are reporting the rumors, and many other things, mashes them all together, and spits out a recommendation to you as to whether or not the rumor is something you may want to pay attention to, wink, wink, or maybe something worth ignoring. It is a great tool to have in your tool belt if you are a day trader and you see these rumors on a daily basis, and they're offering a free trial if you're a podcast listener. So check them out, rumorhound.ai. They're in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my buddy Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer, Russ Valenti, my homeboy Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud, Chris Bede, who has been on almost for 2 years supporting the podcast. I appreciate you, brother. Ken R., Chris Boas, my buddy Ken, Mr. J.K. Cunningham. How about my buddy Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson, Matt Merle, Jameson Trinker, still supporting. I appreciate you guys. And some of my newest patrons, Collins Davis, thank you, my brother, for signing up. Peter Theodorius, I appreciate you. And Andrew Plotnikov, Ryan Chapman, and Steve King. I got your email the other day, Steve, thank you. Jeff Barnes, my buddy, get Andrew Yang on the podcast. Raymond Vendenis, thank you. And some of my older patrons that have been with me for a while, people like Agnes Thank you so much, Agnes, for your continued support. Steven Rasputic, thank you, my friend. Andrew Lindner and Lyle Engel, I still see you, my friend. Ned DeLorme and Harrison Fodorodsky, thank you, my friend, still supporting the podcast, which I appreciate. And Justin Bone, Ethan Watkins, thank you guys so much. All right, two rules for this podcast. You ready? They're simple and easy to follow. One is there's a two-drink minimum. Take two to the face before you get started listening. It's going to make life a lot easier. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about. What you don't want to trust me on is anything involving life advice or financial advice. I hold no licenses. I hold no registrations. I hold nothing with the SEC. I'm not trying to tell you what to do. Don't text me or fucking send me messages about great trades or bad trades. I don't want to hear it. Not investing advice. Do your research elsewhere. We're here for discussion, conversation, journalistic purposes only. Just trying to bat around the old nonsense, shoot the old shit, if you know what I'm saying. And with that being said, I have with me today the president of Euro Pacific Capital, and I was glad to see him on television again yesterday. I don't know what the hell is going on, but I was super stoked to see you get back on Fox Business News. Somebody must have slipped up yesterday in the production department, huh, Peter? I have Mr. Peter Schiff with me. How are you, sir?
You know, I was supposed to be on Friday, actually, with a kind of like a one-on-one debate, but I think the person who was supposed to debate me, I won't say her name, I think she chickened out, so then they moved me over to Wednesday.
Can you say her name in pig Latin? So you won't technically be saying it?
I mean, I don't know for sure, so I'm just speculating, you know.
What were you supposed to be debating about?
I don't know. I don't even know, but anyway. But yeah, no, I was on with Liz Claman. She's fantastic. One of the few hosts in the mainstream that still has me on, so.
I noticed that you are on her show.
I'm glad her show is now the Claman Countdown. I like that name better than Countdown to the Closing Bell. Was too many words, so Claman Countdown is a good ring.
She's one of the only shows I still see on, which is I give her credit for that. I know sometimes I break her balls on Twitter, but I do give her some credit for that. Yeah, last time I saw you, I think the last question you asked me was in Las Vegas in October. It was 8:30 in the morning. We were getting ready to do our little panel, and you asked me, are you going to drink that entire bottle of champagne? And I think that was the last time we talked to each other. I was enjoying myself.
I probably also asked you if you were going to change or if that was your answer.
Yeah. Now, you did that in June, though, when we did the Benzinga conference and I came to meet you. You were like, you didn't go on stage like that, did you? Yeah, actually, I did. Did you enjoy Vegas? Did you enjoy that conference?
Yeah, I mean, it was a small venue. You know, I liked the Nigerian brothers. They're nice guys. So I came out there. It wasn't normally the typical type of conference that I participate in. I'm more, you know, I go to the hard money oriented guys, you know, the gold guys, stuff like that.
I like the Nigerians because they're the same on TV as they are off TV. They don't put on a facade when they go on television.
They're very friendly, down to earth people. So, and from Connecticut, where I just summer in Connecticut because of course I live in Puerto Rico. I would encourage any people who are listening to this podcast to come on down here while the weather's nice and we don't pay taxes, at least federal income taxes. So it's good. It's a good deal.
Yeah, the deal is you got to like surrender your right to vote or something, right?
Oh yeah, well, what's that worth? I can vote in the primary.
That's an easy one.
I just can't vote. I just can't vote in a general election, and we don't have a congressman. But you see, you know, voting is all about trying to get back some of the money the government takes from you. But since the government doesn't take any money from me anymore, or much, very much,
you don't care.
I don't have to worry about trying to get little crumbs back. You know,
right? Right.
And plus, I lived in Connecticut. Right, Chris? I never vote for a winner in Congress. My congressional votes are a complete waste.
Right.
Because the Democrats always win, and I've never voted Democrat in Connecticut. So that was just a waste of time anyway. I mean, you know, what's the big deal about voting for the loser? So, I'm happy not voting at all and just not having to pay the taxes. And, you know, we'll see what happens in 2021. I think taxes really are going to have to go up, even if Trump ends up getting reelected, because the deficits are just going to be so big in the next recession. I mean, they're going to have to raise somebody's taxes, and I'm sure it's going to be on the upper income people. So I'm glad I got out of Dodge when I did. And of course, you know, I didn't make money per se. I mean, we had the subprime short, so that was a big trade, and we had clients that made money in 07 who were short subprime. But remember, my overall thesis going into the financial crisis was that when the real estate market crashed and Fannie and Freddie went bankrupt and we had a financial crisis, the Fed would start printing a bunch of money and slashing interest rates, and that would cause the dollar to go down, right, and gold to go up. So I got everything right except the last part. But, you know, I think the last part is going to happen. It's just going to happen after the next crisis, which is going to be much, much bigger. You know, the dollar is actually going to get killed much more this time than I originally thought it would the last time. And my upside targets for gold, I think, are a lot higher now than they were back then. So, you know, I think the people who are following my advice now as far as how to allocate their stock portfolios, I think we're going to make up for the fact that we didn't, you know, make money in 08. I think we're going to make more than enough the next time when the dollar really does take a bigger way and gold makes an even bigger upside move.
Yeah, you keep cutting out just a little bit, Peter, and I think it might actually be on your end. I don't know. Are you using?
Yeah, I heard that. It may be my phone. You could try calling me on a different landline.
I'm going to call you back.
A voice over IP phone.
Can you send me another number, and I'm going to call you right back.
All right, I'll text you. Bye.
All right. Okay, I have you back, Peter. Yeah, I'm glad that I think you would do well with the Stansberry crowd. I talked to a lot of the guys after I did my speech, and a lot of them are like-minded, so it's a shame that you don't get there. I think you would draw very well there, and hopefully you and Porter can make amends.
I used to work with Doug Casey, who I know quite well, and Porter bought Casey's business, and I was, you know, actually was working on a project with Casey promoting Puerto Rico. We had something out there, and Porter basically got rid of it because I was a part of it.
Oh, is that right?
So yes, because he bought. He's a great. Look, his business is really growing. He's a great marketer. Although, you know, I just saw a commercial that they're running now. I think it's from his group. I'm not even sure, but I think it looked like it was. But now they're touting the last big bull market, trying to get people, instead of being negative, they're very, very optimistic on catching the next bull market. So I don't know. I kind of feel that that trade is over. So that might be another contrarian indicator when, you know, you get the bearish people trying to sell stuff based on bullish calls now on the U.S. stock market when we're near record highs. So we got to be making a major top here.
Nobody can ever accuse you of changing your mind about the way that you feel about economic theory. That's one thing I can say. And I can understand how you would kind of take it personally, especially if, you know, for 8 or 9 years, you're warning everybody about impending bubble burst and basically just taking incoming at all points from the media and from analysts and just, you know how it is. I mean, you swim way upstream. So, and then when it finally happens, having somebody come out and say, yeah, I was saying all that shit too. It's like, hey, where the fuck were you 3 years ago, 4 years ago, right?
Yeah, and I remember when I first got started too, I was going to the money shows and I was debating, Joe Battaglia. I don't know if you remember that guy, but I used to do these debates all the time in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004 with him about the economy. And then, you know, then I started going on CNBC around 2005. That's when they started calling me Dr. Doom because of the stuff that I was saying. But
well, I thought you held your own very well in those debates, which is probably why they wanted to have you on. I mean, I've seen some of them.
Which one? Oh, the bull bear debates?
Yeah, and also some of the ones that you've done on network television. Some of them are on YouTube, so I'd like to go back and watch them. You know,
you don't get a lot of time, though. You know, they're really short. You know, I was on Fox Business the other day, and there were, you know, three of us. And we, you know, so I got to answer two questions, and you know, they were going to be, so it's very short. So you really all I can really get in on network television is a couple of interesting sound bites. I can't really really explain a thesis because there's not enough time.
Yeah, no, and you can definitely expound on what you're saying. because I watched you do it while we were sitting on stage at the Nigerian conference. Yeah. And I actually, I was like, Peter, I was like, you got to let me at least say something. I don't even care if it's about finance. Yeah. You know, just let me in for 1 second. And I was like, yeah. I said like three things and it was like, boom, you just went. But
yeah,
you know,
like,
you know,
I watched on CBC the other day. I mean, there was an interview with Jeff Gundlach and yeah. You know, he had enough time. He was on there for a while and he got to, you know, lay out some of the concerns that he had, of course, all of which I agree with. But yeah, so he gets enough time to really speak in more than just sound bites.
Yeah. And I don't understand why they don't allocate them, because in addition to, you know, look, you're my favorite economist. I like hearing your take on things. I think you have it right. But in addition to that, I don't know, you just seem generally like a funny guy when you're on TV too. I actually saw, there's a thing on YouTube of you doing stand-up comedy somewhere. And I was like, what the hell is he going to talk about doing stand-up comedy? And you did like a set about the government too. And about...
Well, you know, that's stand-up, and anybody who wants to watch that can go on YouTube, just do Peter Schiff stand-up. But yeah, that was, it was New York's funniest reporter, and they invited me to do it. And so all I did, because I know that I used to do a lot of talks, you know, conferences, I would give workshops. And so a lot of the stuff that I said, people would laugh at. So all I really did was take some stuff that I used to say when I was doing my workshops on investing and economics, and I just turned it into a stand-up comedy thing. And then, you know, it worked pretty good. I mean, the people were laughing a lot. I got second place. So I finished just, well, I, you know, it was two women that shared it, and I forget what they did, and they were first place. I remember third place, I think, was Charles Payne.
Oh, God.
He's also from Fox Business. He was pretty funny. I liked his bit, but I forget who else was there. There was a number of us, man, you know, but I remember I was second after these two women, but I can't even remember who they were.
All right. Well, let's dispense with the ass kissing here and, move right into the fact that the market raged the Dow was up, I think, another 200 points today. We're up to all time highs on this phase one trade deal, which it looks like has been finalized now for the 15th time. The hell is going on, Peter? What do you say to somebody that just, you know, keeps saying, hey, Peter, you just keep missing it, buddy? Here we are at SPY, 3,100 or whatever.
Well, I didn't say the Dow couldn't keep rising. I mean, I think it's eventually going to get killed. So, but that doesn't mean it can't make new highs. I mean, bubbles get bigger before they pop. You know, it was interesting, too, that the market was down this morning. We had the biggest spike in unemployment claims in the highest level in over 2 years, over 250,000 weekly claims. So we'll see if that's the beginning of a trend. But, you know, gold was up another 10 bucks this morning after having been up, you know, over 10 bucks yesterday. And then Trump comes out with this tweet, you know, with capital letters and exploration points, you know, this huge deal, this great deal is very close. And yeah, I mean, how many times have we seen that before? But the market still, you know, comes running when a Trump cries wolf on trade. But we'll see. I mean, but the bottom line is, even if we actually get a deal, it's nothing. It's phase one, which basically means that none of the really important things are included. So it's not the comprehensive, game-changing type of deal that Trump campaigned on and promised. It's just going to be a face-saving, cosmetic deal. The best part about the deal might be that the tariffs that Trump imposed get rolled back. So basically all that happens is we go back to where we were before we fought the trade war. And so that's what people are potentially celebrating, that we're not going to inflict more damage on our own economy. But I've been saying for a long time that when this deal is finally inked, you know, it's more likely to be a buy the rumor, sell the fact.
Right.
You know, and I'm amazed that they keep buying the rumor as often as they have, because I kept, you know, there may never be a fact. And in fact, I thought Trump's strategy may be to never actually have a trade deal. That way he can constantly tease that one's around the corner and people will keep buying stocks, wanting to be long when the deal is announced. So we'll see. But if we actually get one, it's thing. I mean, what's far more significant is, you know, what the Fed said. If you listen to the press conference by Powell yesterday, basically reiterating the fact that the Fed damn how high inflation goes, that they're not even considering raising rates, that before they were to raise rates, inflation would have to be much higher than it is now. I mean, they don't even acknowledge what that number is, even though year over year, the core CPI is up 2.3%, headline's up 2.1%, and they're saying, well, we need to be much higher than this. But not just that, it has to be a lot higher, and it has to be sustainable, right? And so how long does inflation have to stay at 3 or 4% before the Fed thinks that it's sustainable?
Right.
And, of course, while they're waiting to see if it's sustainable, what if it gets to 5 or 6%? I mean, all of this is a bunch of nonsense. Central bankers are supposed to preempt inflation. They're not supposed to take any chances because the expression, never let the inflation genie out of the bottle, that expression is there because of experience of how hard it is to get the inflation genie back into the bottle
right.
once you let it out.
Right.
And basically what Powell is saying is, oh, we're going to make sure the genie is definitely out of the bottle, way, way out, before we do anything to try to put it back in. The problem is, who are they fooling? Because if they actually let inflation get that high, they can never do anything about it. Because the reason they don't want to do anything about inflation now is because they can't. Because all they can do about inflation is raise interest rates and shrink the money supply, which means go back to quantitative tightening and hike rates. But they already reversed that because everything was imploding at the end of last year. And so, like I said, they would never be able to normalize interest rates. They would never be able to shrink their balance sheet. The Fed had to start cutting rates immediately. They had to start going, they had to go back to quantitative easing because the air was coming out of the bubble. And if they tried to fight inflation, then, well, they would prick the bubble all over again.
Right.
So they're never going to fight inflation because they can't, because the cure would kill us, right? In order to fight inflation, they would tank the stock market, tank the real estate market, tank the bond market, bankrupt the banks. We'd have a, you know, a worse financial crisis than 08. The key is, when are the markets going to figure out that the Fed is basically full of it, that it's all bark and no bite on inflation fighting, and that inflation is going to run rampant, and, you know, the dollar is toast. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And the question is, when more people figure this out, and then they want to start front running that trade. In fact, one of the comments that Gundlach made that I pretty much agree with most of what he says, but this is something that, you know, the mainstream should be thinking about, is that you've got all of these Europeans and Asians who have tried to escape negative yielding bonds by buying higher yielding U.S. bonds, U.S. Treasuries, or corporate bonds. But they've done so unhedged, because if they were to hedge the currency risk, which would be the prudent thing to do, especially considering how much risk there is in the dollar, but the cost of putting on that hedge is so high that they would end up losing money because the yields are too low to cover the cost. So what they're doing is they're taking a big risk. But you've got European or Asian pension funds, insurance companies that have euro liabilities or dollar or yen liabilities, let's say, but now they have dollar assets, dollar, and then all of a sudden the dollar tanks. These are huge losses.
Right.
And then they're going to, of course, once the market starts to fall, that's when these guys are going to bail on their trades. You know, if foreigners were hedging their dollar risk the way they should be, the dollar would already be a lot lower. It's because they haven't hedged, they haven't had to sell dollars. But the dollar should have already tanked. In fact, if you look at the dollar index, surprisingly, right, the dollar index is slightly higher today than it was at the end of last year. And that is despite the fact that instead of getting the 3 to 4 rate hikes, that, you know, Goldman Sachs was looking for 4 rate hikes in 2019. And that was priced into the dollar.
Right.
And instead, we got 3 rate cuts. People thought that the Fed was going to shrink its balance sheet. It was on autopilot, $50 billion a month. And we ended up going back to quantitative easing. See, the funny thing is, the markets surprised everybody by doing exactly what I said they were going to do. Yet, the dollar didn't fall, which is something that I expected it to do when everybody got surprised by what I knew the Fed was going to do. Now, I don't think that means that I was wrong about the dollar falling. I just think that the fall was delayed. And gold did have a decent year this year. I mean, gold had and especially considering that the dollar didn't fall. I mean, gold stocks, I made as much in gold stocks this year, maybe even a little more, than people made in the S&P 500. You know, but one of the big differences is, you know, the S&P 500 earnings are actually down about 1% on the year, while gold stock earnings are up maybe 70% this year.
Right.
So gold stocks are actually cheaper now on a PE basis than they were at the beginning of the year, while, you know, the S&P is far more expensive. And what that means, too, the fact that earnings are down and stock prices are up, right, and it's just multiple expansion, this is all the Fed, right? Trump can claim credit for the stock market going up all he wants, but it's not the economy. In fact, if the economy is the reason the market is going up, it's because the economy sucks. And the Fed, it's keeping the Fed to, you know, on hold, or they cut rates, or they promise no rate hikes. That's what's going on. So it's cheap money that is driving the stock market, the same thing that drove it when Obama was president. Trump knew it then. He criticized the bubble economy. But now, of course, that's all he talks about.
And that's been the trade for a while. Like, we'll get shit economic macro data in the morning, you know, whatever, and the market will rally on the shit data, not because of the data itself, but because the data is supposed to catalyze, you know, Fed intervention, and people see that as bullish for the market. So our thinking is completely turned around backwards and has been for some time, right?
Well, look, everything is bullish as far as investors are concerned. And so far, you know, people have been right. I mean, right. Going back to Goldman Sachs again. See, Goldman Sachs, they were bullish on the stock market, right? And not just Goldman, but everybody else. But everybody says that they're the smartest. I don't, you know, whatever. But so they thought the U.S. stock market was going to go up in 2019. But they also thought the Fed was going to hike rates 4 times. Now, there was no way that that was going to happen. They just didn't understand that. If the Fed actually raised rates as many times as Goldman thought, the stock market would have collapsed in 2019.
Right.
The only reason that they were right about the stock market going up is because they were wrong about the Fed, because they didn't understand the dynamics of the economy. I did. I knew there was no way the Fed could hike rates that much, but I still didn't want to be in U.S. stocks because I thought I could make more money in gold stocks or foreign stocks, because I expected the dollar to be very weak when people realized that the Fed wasn't going to be able to fulfill its promise and that it was going to cut rates. So, and I think I probably should have made more money on this trade than I did, but I think I'm going to. I just think it's a delayed reaction. People just really don't understand the predicament that the Fed is in. And, you know, other central banks, of course, got into the action, and all of a sudden everybody started easing again. And so it wasn't like the Fed was easing, you know, in a vacuum. You know, people looked at a race to the bottom that they thought, well, maybe, you know, we would lose that race. I still think we win that race. But
the funny thing, Peter, is that when we were going through the quantitative tightening, you know, after the Fed balance sheet ballooned by trillions, and we started, you know, relatively nominal quantitative tightening, everybody kind of turned around and was like, see, it works. Like, we're tightening now and there's no problem. Completely ignoring the fact that the amount that they were tightening was meaningless relative to how big the balance sheet had gotten. And you were one of the only people out there saying, it still doesn't matter. This still isn't going to last. And if you look at a chart of the size of the Fed's balance sheet, you know, you see this small downtick while the Fed was tightening for a small amount of time, and now here we are right back up on the upswing. So you were 100% right.
I mean, we're above $4 trillion in the balance sheet. I mean, we were supposed to be substantially lower than this, you know, when the Fed was first pretending that they were going to do it. But, you know, but I knew they couldn't do it. And again, you know, when people look at this economy and they try to say that we have a strong economy, we don't have a strong economy. It's a bubble. The only reason that the numbers look good is because interest rates are artificially low. I mean, where would the economy be? Where would the market be if interest rates were being set by supply and demand? If the Federal Reserve said today, right, if the Fed came out and said, hey, we're no longer going to manipulate interest rates. We no longer have a target. We're not going to do any open market operations.
Right.
We're just going to step back, and we're just going to let interest rates find their level. And it really doesn't matter what's happening in the economy. We don't care about the economic data, right? We're not going to try to artificially stimulate the economy. we're just going to allow free market capitalism to work, right? We're just going to let the market discover the appropriate rate of interest, and you know, just like the market discovers every other price, right? We don't have a board to decide how much milk should cost, or how much bread should cost, or gasoline, or an iPhone, right? All these things are determined by supply and demand. We let, you know, buyers and sellers, you know, find the right price. So if the Fed basically said, that's what we're going to do, we're going to step back, right? I think that bond prices would crash, right? And interest rates would rise, which makes sense, right? You know, the supply of savings, that the savings pool is very shallow in right. the United States. We have record government borrowing. We have, you know, record twin deficits now. Our trade deficits and our budget deficits are skyrocketing. You know, we're borrowing more money today than even Obama did during the Great Recession. Consumer debt records, corporate debt. So, you know, interest rates should be a lot higher. So let's say that, I don't know where the real rate of interest is, but let's say interest rates should be 6%, right, short-term rates. I mean, it probably should be higher than that, but right. let's say 6%. And let's say mortgage rates should be 8%, right? And, of course, what would even happen if the government said, you know what, we're closing Fannie and Freddie, right? We're not going to guarantee mortgages anymore. So you, bank, if you loan money to somebody to buy a house, you're on the hook if they don't pay, right? You have to make sure that the borrower is actually creditworthy and can right. afford a house that you're loaning him money to buy, right?
Right.
So we did this, you know, but we're, I mean,
the stock market would fall 50%. The stock market would fall 50% overnight if that happened. I said the market would fall 50% overnight if that happened. If rates went to 6%,
even if we didn't do the Fannie and Freddie stuff, if we just let interest rates go up,
right?
I mean, the housing market would collapse because the mortgage rates would go up, prices would implode. The stock market would crash because PEs would, you know, would come down.
Crash
plus all the corporate debt. You'd have a wave. One of the other points that Jeff Gundlach made, he said, and this is, you know, Main Street talking, not even me, that something like 35% of all the corporate bonds today that have investment grades should really be rated junk. But the rating agencies are again asleep at the switch,
sure.
and they are overrating. But during the next economic downturn, right, you could see, you know, half maybe of the current investment grade bonds downgraded to junk. I mean, we're going to have a collapse in the corporate bond market. Interest rates are going to spike. I mean, the consumer spending is going to implode. I mean, we would have, forget about the 08 financial crisis, because they kept saying that was the worst crisis since the Great Depression. Well, if the Fed allowed interest rates to normalize, we would have the worst crisis, including the Great Depression.
Right.
But that means it's inevitable, because the Federal Reserve can't artificially suppress interest rates forever. They've done it for a long time, and they've created enormous economic imbalances. But the longer they succeed in delaying the day of reckoning, the more we have to reckon with when that day eventually arrives. So all they're doing is sealing our fate, right? They're not eliminating the day of reckoning. They're just making sure that when it comes, it's that much worse. And so that's why they can't fight inflation. That's why they have to keep raising their inflation target. They just want to kick this can down the road for as long as they can. You know, just like Bernie Madoff, right? He was hoping he can get away with his Ponzi scheme probably until he died. And then, you know, they would have to figure it out.
Right.
You know? but it didn't go on that long, right? This one is going to end. It's going to end very badly, unfortunately. And, you know, the political implications are terrible, of course, because capitalism is once again going to get the blame for a crisis that was caused by socialism, by government
right.
intervention,
right.
government micromanagement through the Federal Reserve, but also, you know, big government and big government spending and regulation. I mean, capitalism has got nothing to do with the crisis that we're going to go through, just like it had nothing to do with the 08 crisis. But it gets blamed when government intervention causes a problem.
Well, and people, they don't understand. I mean, a great video of you is the one where you walk through the economic the protests on Wall Street, and you try to reason with people and explain government's role in the markets and how that caused the collapse. But the problem is that the everyday investor and the mom and pop doesn't understand. They can't parse out the government and the central bank's intervention in various markets and the manipulation that we're talking about with capitalism. So what happens is, you're right, socialism is what's causing the problem. Micromanaging of free markets is what's causing the problem. Yet at the end of the day, when the whole thing goes ass up, capitalism winds up getting the blame, which is, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, so government wins again.
It's because the worst of both worlds.
Ride to the rescue.
Right,
with, you know,
exactly.
More government. But, you know, a great, I don't know if you've seen, have you seen the Bubble movie?
No, I haven't.
All right, so you got to watch that movie. It's a documentary. They started filming it almost 10 years ago when I did the first interview with Jimmy Morrison, who's the producer of it, or, you know, director, producer. David Tice also was involved in producing it. If you remember him, Prudent Bear. But it's out now. You go to letusdisagree.com is the website. And it's a great, you know, documentary. It interviews a lot of people. I'm one of them, but a lot of good people. Ron Paul, you know, is there, and some of the other Austrian-type guys, Jim Rogers, and Doug Casey is in it, who I mentioned earlier. But we go over why we had a financial crisis,
right?
You know, and how the Federal Reserve created it, and all this. And there's a lot of history, so it's a great, you know, well done documentary, entertaining to watch, and it's good to for people to, you know, who don't know this, right? So if you have some friends who, you know, still believe the conventional wisdom, have them watch the Bubble movie, and more importantly, the sequel is going to be coming out, I think, next year about the bigger crash that's coming. And maybe it'll basically come out right as that collapse happens. Because, you know, my second book is The Real Crash, because I think that, you know, the 08 crash was not. It was like, you know, the overture to an opera. And when I wrote my first book, you know, a lot of people thought that the 08 crash was what I was referring to in the title, but it wasn't. See, when I was predicting the collapse of the real estate market and the great recession that would ensue, right? Then I looked forward to how the government would respond. I knew they would cut interest rates and print money and do wrong things. And I thought that that would create a dollar crisis. So I didn't think the economic crash was going to be the great recession and the real estate crashing. I thought that was going to, what that was going to set into motion, a government policy that would create, that would crash the economy. So I said that we would not die of the disease that I was diagnosing. What was going to be fatal was the government's cure for this disease. And so that's what hasn't happened, but that's going to happen. That collapse, that real crash, was delayed by about a decade because the Fed actually succeeded in doing something that I thought they would fail at. I thought they would try to reflate the bubbles. Instead, they succeeded, and they made them even bigger. And so they bought some time, but it's going to end up costing us dearly.
The worst part is that even, you know, as the government rides to the rescue after all of these collapses, as they did in 2008, it gives people the firepower to justify the euphoria as it's happening. So it just builds on itself. So now, you know, everybody has forgotten the lessons of 2008. I mean, it's one of those things that when it happens, people are beside themselves that it happened, and they swear up and down, you know, we're going to remember this. And then here we are 10 years later, and it's as if 2008 never happened. And so the government provides them with this false sense of security that they're going to be able to kind of, you know, swoosh in and save the day again should something like this happen, when people don't even see what's going on. It's just one building block after another moving to a bigger and bigger problem until we reach escape velocity and we hit the problem that can't be fixed.
Yeah. And, you know, the problem is, too, people like me or whoever who have been out there warning about the problems, the fact that the stock market keeps making record highs and the fact that people still think that the economy is fine, that just emboldens the bullish, you know, narrative that, you know, everything is great and
right.
We shouldn't listen to people like Peter Schiff, because look, if you listen to Peter Schiff, you missed out on this big big stock market rally. And, you know, they were saying that stuff when I was coming on CNBC in 2006, 2007. And the reality was I was actually making a lot more money back then as a bear because I was in gold stocks and foreign stocks, and they were crushing the S&P. So, you know, what's happened these last few years, the S&P has outperformed, but that's not something that's going to happen indefinitely. That happened for a period of time, which I think is an aberration, because the policies that we're pursuing are very, very dollar bearish. And so in a weak dollar environment, you will make a lot more money investing outside the United States, except that we've had a strong dollar environment, but the dollar hasn't been strong for the right reasons. It's part of the bubble. And so it's going to pop. But because, you know, people don't think that this is a problem, they're not worried, right? But, you know, look at the people who were worried about the national debt, you know, when it was a trillion, when it got to a trillion. Right. The first time it got to a trillion is when Ronald Reagan was president. And, you know, the Tea Party, you know, the Tea Party movement really started in response to the Obama deficits when the national debt, you know, was $8 trillion, $9 trillion, whoever got to. We're at $23 trillion and rising, and no one cares. You know, I mean, you know, the Democratic debates, there hasn't been a single question about what are you going to do about the national debt? What are you going to do about the budget deficits? So obviously the Democrats don't care, but the Republicans don't care anymore either. And just think, oh, well, it's nothing to worry about, because look how big it is. I mean, why were we wasting our time worrying about the deficit with national debt when it's tripled, quadrupled, and when we haven't had a problem? Well, we have had a problem. It just hasn't resulted in a crisis yet. But by the time the problem turns into a crisis, you can't do anything about it. So that's what, but you know, that's what government does. They wait for a crisis. They don't want to preempt a crisis because that's bad politics. And Wall Street does the same thing, right? Because most people on Wall Street, they are managing other people's money. So they really don't give a damn in the end what happens to it, right, as long as they get their fees. And so they want to just keep dancing as long as the music is playing. They don't worry about what's going to happen when the music stops because it hasn't stopped yet. And nobody wants to stop dancing and the party keeps going on without them, right? Because right, that's how you get fired, right? You miss out on the gain. So everybody just wants to keep this thing going as long as it can, and no one gives a damn about the ultimate consequences. I mean, politicians don't care because they can only see to the next election. So why should they care about a problem that may not that happens when they're not even in office?
Yeah, and so that half of them don't even understand it. That's part of the problem. I mean, they don't give a shit, but the other half of them don't understand it.
Yeah, and Wall Street, right, hey, we can keep generating our fees. As long as we generate paper profits for our investors, we can keep, you know, raking it with our fees. And then when everything implodes and everybody gets wiped out, well, we'll try to get bailed out by the government. Right, that's the other moral hazard.
Right.
You know, why ever leave the party, right? You don't have to worry about being arrested, right, and going to jail because you're going to get bailed out by the government. So, you know, why stop partying? Just party forever because there's no consequences. You know, and I think people even saw that in the 08 crisis. There were banks out there. There were bankers who didn't want to participate in the subprime lending. They knew it was going to end badly.
Right.
And so they stayed away. And as a result of staying away, you know, they didn't make as much money as their competitors who were, you know, taking advantage of this. But then after everything collapsed, instead of those guys going bankrupt, they got bailed out.
Right.
So
the people who made the right decision didn't get rewarded for their correct decision making and their risk aversion. They got a smack in the face and said, "Hey, next time."
Yeah, and the people who made the bad choices got bailed out.
Right.
So you send two negative messages. You send a message to the people that were incompetent and reckless and say, "Hey, keep doing that. There's no consequences." But then we send a message to the people who are prudent, and we say, "What? Don't be prudent. That's foolish. You might as well just gamble like everybody else because you'll just get bailed out. There's no reason to give up any income now."
Right. Right?
Had the government simply allowed all the reckless bankers to lose their jobs and lose their money, then the prudent bankers would have taken over and bought out their assets. Right. So that would have been a healthy cleansing. That would have been capitalism working, right?
Right.
The smart, right, prudent bankers pick up the pieces when all the reckless guys are wiped out. Instead, we bailed out all the reckless guys so they can get bigger and bigger and bigger and then buy up a lot of their prudent competitors and then, you know, and then corrupt their companies.
Yeah, it's exactly what happened. I mean, it's. I'd be interested in your take on the moral hazard that would be created if the Democratic policy of just canceling all student debt occurs, because this kind of dovetails from what we're talking about now, which is sending the wrong message. I think, like many others do, look, I'm not against all relief for people that have student loans. I think maybe there are some small things that we could do to provide some economic relief. But the idea of canceling over $1 trillion in debt does create a substantial moral hazard where, again, you are rewarding.
Well, it depends, Chris. It depends on how you do it. I mean, I have some sympathy with the idea that we cancel the student debt, because I do think that the students were, in fact, defrauded. I mean, you're talking about young kids, you know, who 18 years old, who are being told, hey, your life is ruined unless you go to college.
Right.
You just have to have a college degree, or, you know, you're just going to be a fry cook. The reality is, people cooking French fries have college degrees anyway. I mean, so even if you get a degree, you still could be cooking French fries. But these kids, you know, they were conned into borrowing a bunch of money because the government's guaranteed the loans. I mean, that was the problem. None of these kids could have borrowed this money but for the government guarantees. And but for the government guarantees, the colleges wouldn't have been able to get away with these outrageous fees, the tuition.
Right.
So, you know, the government has basically been in bed with the colleges and universities to enable the universities to rip off the kids with government money. And so it's been a disaster, right? So we need to end government involvement in higher education. I mean, I'd like to end government involvement in all education, but let's just, you know, talk about higher education, because that's where the federal government is mainly involved. But we need to get the federal government out of it. So if we were to say something like, okay, we're going to forgive all the student loans, we're going to wipe out all the student debt, recognizing that that's a loss for taxpayers, so, you know, maybe we, you know, we have to have a tax hike or something, or maybe we have to cut some other government spending to cover the cost of, you know, $1.5 trillion loss, right, to the taxpayer. Although I don't know that we should forgive, debt that was accumulated for a medical degree or a legal degree or something like that. But I mean, just, you know, a lot of these liberal art undergrad degrees are basically worthless, and people borrowed a lot of money to get them. But what has to be done is the government has to say, there's no more government loans. They're done, right? So then there's no moral hazard. But if we forgive the student loans that exist, but we continue to make government student loans available to new borrowers, oh my God. Well, everybody's going to take out bigger loans, and then the colleges are going to be able to say, don't worry about these loans. You're just never going to have to pay them back. In fact, the colleges would start including brand new cars with their freshman tuition. I mean, they would just start jacking up. They would throw everything in there because, you know, it's all going to be forgiven. Just borrow, borrow, borrow. I mean, that would make the moral hazard even bigger. In fact, I have a niece that's going to college. And already I'm like, you know, no, we shouldn't pay for it. My son could potentially go to college. You met Spencer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I'm like, well, no, we just got to take out a loan. Because why be an idiot and pay for college? I mean, they're already dangling the idea of forgiving student loans. All right, well, then why should we pay for college? I mean, because you could borrow the money right now. The interest doesn't even start accumulating until after you graduate. So why not take out a loan? Because if they forgive the loans, you'd feel like an idiot if you actually paid the tuition.
Right.
So it's already creating a moral hazard now, in that there's an expectation that the loans are going to be forgiven. So you'd have to be a fool to actually pay cash when you could get the degree for free. So the only way that it can be done without a moral hazard is to completely end the student loan program. I mean, no more government guaranteed student loans. No more direct issued government student loans. That's it, right? And then it should go back to the way it was when my father went to college. My father was the youngest of 8 children. His parents were, lower middle class or upper lower class. I mean, they were not wealthy by any stretch, right? And my father's parents didn't have enough money to send my dad to college. Not that college was even that expensive in those days. But most of my dad's friends' parents didn't pay for their college. So my dad did what everybody else did. He worked his way through college. He had a summer job waiting tables in the Catskills at a resort. And that one summer job waiting tables, 18, 19, 20, the money he earned doing that was enough to cover the entire year of room, board, tuition, just all of his expenses he could pay by having a summer job. That's how cheap college was. He went to the University of Connecticut. That's how inexpensive it was before the government got involved to try to bring down the cost. See, before the government got involved in education, right, it was very affordable, and anybody who wanted to go, either their parents could pay for it because it wasn't that expensive, or they can get a job and pay for it. But some liberal politicians came up and said, hey, we got a great idea. You shouldn't have to work your way through college. We're just going to let you borrow money, right? You could just pay it back after you graduate. I mean, why work now? Have fun. Go out and party. You shouldn't have to waste your summers waiting tables. Just have fun, and you could just pay back these guaranteed student loans after you graduate because you're going to earn more money, right? It'll be easier to repay the loans. Why should you have a crappy job now? Just, you know, wait until you get graduate. And that's how it all started. It was a way for politicians to buy votes of young people by promising them, you know, a cheaper way to go to college. But what ended up happening, which is always the case when you get in bed with the government, you know, they screw you over, but it backfired. So government student loans ended up making college degrees extremely expensive. It made the opposite of what it was accomplishing.
Right.
But at the same time, this is the real beauty of it. Not only did government succeed in taking something that was very affordable and making it really expensive, but they also took something that was very valuable, a college degree, and basically made it practically worthless in the market. Because the government encouraged so many people to go to college that never should have gone, all of a sudden everybody had college degrees. It wasn't just certain people that had them. Everybody had them. So if everybody has it, what's it worth? Nothing.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to differentiate yourself, you got to go to graduate school. You need a master's. You need a PhD. Kids are staying in college till they're 30, right? But all of this is because of government. All of this malinvestment. That's what it is. It's malinvestment. We have too much invested in a higher education. Look at these universities. Go down to these things. I mean, their payrolls are enormous. Everything is bloated, right? There's all this government money. They did the same thing with healthcare, right? Everything the government gets involved in, they destroy the quality and the price goes through the roof, right? That's what we always complain about. People complain about the high cost of healthcare and the high cost of education. Those are the two things that the government is heavily involved with. Right? The things that the government is not involved with, people don't complain about because the prices go down.
Yeah, I know. And it's just people just realize you just got to let the market work. You know, just let the market work. The more intervention, the worse things get. The more you skew the playing field, the worse things get for the consumer. You know, colleges used to have to compete. Right? They used to have to compete. And now that there's all this free money available for anybody to just make their tuition, the colleges, it removes the incentive for colleges to offer something that's better than the next college. You know,
you can get the loans. They don't care whether you're majoring in chemical engineering or, you know, or Chicano studies.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter what your major is. You can borrow the money at the same interest rate. It doesn't matter if you were an A student and you got 1,500 on your SATs, or if you were a C-minus student and you got 900 on your SATs,
right,
you can still get the money.
Right.
I mean, so it's lunacy. And the crazy thing, or the thing that frustrates me the most, is when you watch these Democratic debates and you see one candidate after another talking about how terrible it is that we have all this student debt, and without understanding that if it wasn't for the liberal politicians,
right,
none of them would have this debt.
Right, exactly.
This is government programs backfiring. And the unintended consequences of government programs and the unintended consequences of the asinine programs that they're advocating now, Medicare for all, free college, whatever it is. I mean, all these unintended consequences are even bigger, even worse.
Yeah, and it's just going to exacerbate things, not unlike the Fed coming in and quote-unquote solving the market's problems. It's just going to make things worse going forward. Listen,
the problem, too, and I was warning, you know, like Kudlow and all his guests, you know, and I used to do the Kudlow show at Kudlow and Company and whatever they had. He had a few different shows back in the day when Bush was president. And I was like, look, you know, all you guys are just cheerleading this bubble economy. And, you know, you should be criticizing it like I am, but
right.
you're, you know, you don't want to criticize the economy when there's a Republican at the, you know, at the top of it. But I said, when this house of cards collapses, you know, you're not going to have any credibility. I mean, who's going to, you know, because you were saying it was great. Well, I was right about that because that's why we had Obama. Well, the same thing now. I mean, the Republicans are talking about how great the economy is. It's a booming economy. Credit Donald Trump. Everything is fantastic. Everything is great. Well, if it falls apart, right, then how is our voters going to believe anything coming out of the Republican side? Oh, you told us everything was great. Now it's a complete disaster. And you said that the economy was great because you cut taxes and you deregulated. Well, now the economy is a disaster. It must be because you cut taxes and deregulated. So we need more taxes and more regulation.
Right.
You told us that those things were going to were doing great, and it turned out that you were wrong. So, you know, because the crisis that's coming is going to be so much worse, and, you know, we're going to get somebody worse than Obama. I mean, Obama was bad, but a lot of the things that he did that were bad were papered over by the Fed. I mean, if they weren't able to keep interest rates so artificially low for the 8 years he was president, a lot of the mistakes that were made would have been, you know, more painfully experienced in the real economy. But
right.
we, you know, kicked the can down the road. But as bad as Obama was, I mean, can you imagine Sanders or Warren?
No.
You know?
I mean, I don't. I try to, you know, I think, too, we talk about 2020, and I've said on a previous podcast, I forget who I was talking to, but I think Trump might win just because I think there is a faction of voters that vote with their wallets, regardless of their party affiliation. And even though they're, you know, falsely under the impression that the economy is doing well, I think that might be the catalyst for him getting reelected. But what you're saying is you think Republicans should adopt the stance that we are in a bubble, which is what Trump ran on, as you said, and take the opportunity to otherwise, when we do have the next crash, everybody's going to get the wrong message again, like you said. People are going to think the Republican policies were to blame and, you know, that we need more taxes and we need more government, which is only going to serve to exacerbate things further.
Yeah, and I don't know that a lot of people are feeling any kind of recovery because, you know, if you look again beneath the surface, a lot of people are not seeing any real growth in their incomes. Their debts are rising. You know,
right.
they have more debt today than they had 3 years ago when they voted for Trump. They don't have a meaningful increase in their salaries, but the cost of living is going up. Things are getting more expensive. So I don't know that people going back to the polls are going to feel, oh, this is great. You know, I want to keep this thing going. I mean, maybe they'll think, oh, my God, it can be so much worse under Sanders or
right.
Warren. But, you know, if the economy is, you know, measurably in a recession, I mean, if the economic narrative switches, and I can see that, you know, the media has been giving – decent coverage to the economy in that it's been conceding that the economy is good. But they may not be that way, you know, once the election is coming, because the media obviously is very biased and very liberal. And, you know, once, you know, they got Trump committed to running on the economy, that's when they can pull the rug out from under him
right.
by really focusing on the problems in the economy, problems that have persisted, that haven't been solved, you know. And so if we're getting, you know, more negative coverage on the economy and if we slip into an official recession, then Trump has no chance.
Maybe he used that as an opportunity to force feed some Austrian economics to some liberals.
Well, he won't have the opportunity. He's not going to get reelected. He's just going to have a few months as a lame duck, but I don't think anything is going to happen.
No, but I mean, if they want to make that argument going into the election, which is what you're saying, essentially, they want to take his one issue, the economy, and they want to argue against him. I mean, if the Democrats were smart, they would be arguing what you're arguing. They would be arguing the fundamentals. You know?
I mean, that's it. They're not smart, but what they are going to say is that, you know, look, that we still have a lot of people working part-time jobs who want full-time jobs. We still have a lot of people who have left the labor force because they have given up hope of finding a job. We have, you know, a lot of people struggling. A lot of people have debt. They don't have any way of retiring, right? That's, you know, that's just the reality for most Americans. And they're going to say that's because the rich have too much money and taxes are too low and we need more government programs. We need a wealth tax. We need this and that from government. So that's going to enable them. I mean, even Elizabeth Warren, every once in a while, if you listen to her talk, I mean, she will start to say some of the same things that I say. You know, she'll point out some of the same problems that I point out. Of course, she has no idea why these problems exist.
Right.
And her solutions will actually make them worse. But she recognizes that there are these problems. But these problems are not the result of a failure of capitalism. They're the result of a failure to have capitalism. They're a result of the type of government programs that she wants to expand.
Right.
Right. But, you know, with Trump and the Republicans are pretending, because they have a base of conservatives that, you know, believe in smaller government and
right.
fewer regulations, lower tax. And so they have to appeal to that base by pretending that they've done this stuff, that they've shrunk government and that they've got government off your back and, you know, they've deregulated. Now they have to pretend that. But then when it all blows up, you know, they leave this big window of opportunity. And, you know, this is going to happen, even if Trump somehow manages to get reelected, right? We're not going to make it for another 4 years without a recession.
Right.
And the next recession is the last recession. The next recession, we can't get out of. That's the end of it, right? That's why, you know, they're doing everything they can to delay it. It's going to be hyperinflation or runaway inflation, and it's going to be an inflationary depression. It's going to be a disaster. And so, you know, if we don't get the socialists in 2020, we're getting them in 2024. There is no way a Republican, there's no way Mike Pence is going to be able to run on 4 more years in 2024. I mean, so either way, you've got to be prepared.
I don't know who the hell the Republican candidate would be in 2024. I mean, you don't think Mike Pence is going to run for president, do you?
Yeah, well, if Trump got reelected, I mean, you know, you look at Pence, but... either the socialists are going to come to power in 2021 or 2025, right? It's just inevitable because the collapse is going to be blamed on Trump if it happens before this election or after. I just think there's no way that we could possibly get through another 5 years. We'll see if we can even get through another 1 year. You know, the fact that the Fed already had to, abort the rate hikes and abort the QT is a very good indication that we're close to the end. I mean,
right.
They were pushed to doing that based on everything imploding. You know, had they not cut rates and gone back to quantitative easing, we would already be in recession and the market would be deep in bear market territory. So they bought some time. How much time did they buy? I don't know. I don't think there's any way they bought 5 years. But we'll see if there's another year there. I don't know.
Well, more
but
likely,
investors need to be.
It's more likely that they're interjecting in, you know, in the repo market and ending the QT and lowering rates. It's more likely that they're just sending what we're seeing now is not even market mechanical. It's just a sentiment shift in investors that think, okay, the Fed is still there no matter what. I mean, I think it's less a function of actually the market mechanics, and it's more of a confidence game.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Powell put is bigger than ever. I mean, that's why Powell took any rate hikes off the table. That's basically
right.
His assurance to the market. He basically said, just don't even worry about the rates ever going up. It's just never going to happen.
Right.
So just take that risk off the table, and you can price that into the stock market. But people are overestimating the ability of the Fed to save the day. And they're not going to be able to do it. And look, we've already antagonized the rest of the world. I mean, the Chinese, the Russians, who's going to be buying our bonds? I mean, you know, when we had the financial crisis in 2008 and we first went to quantitative easing, foreign central banks all around the world were big buyers of U.S. Treasuries. They're not going to do it next time.
Right.
I mean, there's no way that's going to happen. I mean, so it's all going to be on the Fed.
No, they're going to be happy. They're going
to
be happy to watch it happen.
Do all the money printing.
They're going to be happy to watch it happen.
Oh, our trading. Yeah, I mean, everybody was like China was like, oh, we got to prop up America because they're a big market. You know, we sell them all our stuff. Sure,
right.
We loan them the money to buy it. But, you know, I think when the U.S. collapses now at this point, since we've, you know, antagonized so many other people, people are going to say good riddance. You know, people are going to be happy to see us, you know, cut down a few pegs.
And meanwhile,
and it's probably going to be more than a few.
Meanwhile, where has the gold been going over the last couple of years, Peter, worldwide?
Well, look, gold's been going up. I mean, gold has.
No, I mean, where's the physical gold been going?
Oh, all right, well, let's answer both those questions. I mean, the physical gold has been moving east. It's been moving to central banks who are quietly buying up gold. And the reason they're doing that, I believe, is because they are preparing for a U.S. dollar crisis.
Right.
When they are going to have to hold more of their reserves in gold, right? There are a lot of people who are very complacent with the dollar's role as the reserve currency or the primary reserve currency because they don't think there's any other currency that is ready to take its place. And I would agree with that. I mean, I don't think any currency should be the reserve currency. I think gold should be the reserve, not somebody else's liability.
Sure.
Because that's the way it was. See, before Bretton Woods, right, all the central banks around the world, their currencies were pegged to gold. They were actually fixed to it, and they had gold reserves. And what the United States did is we convinced the world, hey, why are you all independently, you know, on a, you know, holding gold? Just hold dollars as your reserves. We've got gold, right? The dollar is as good as gold. If you have $35, we'll give you an ounce of gold. We promise, right? We'll put it right on the bills. IOU, right? So you can hold dollars and you can get interest, and we'll hold all the gold. And so we kind of conned the world into going into this arrangement. So then 1971 came, and, you know, we had been printing a lot of money and running big deficits in the 60s. You know, we had the war on poverty, great society, we went to the moon, we fought the Vietnam War, and we paid for a lot of that by going into debt. And then all of a sudden our creditors started to realize that we didn't have enough gold, and they started exchanging their paper dollars for real gold, and right, gold was leaving the U.S. And so we ended up going off the gold standard, and we say, hey, you know, the dollar's no longer redeemable in anything. Right, that's it. You know, you trusted us. Well, we're just screwing you over. We're defaulting, and that's what we did. And then the dollar during the 1970s, the dollar lost about 2/3 of its value. The yen tripled, the Swiss franc, the Deutschmark tripled. Oil prices went up tenfold. Right, gold went from 35 to 800. I mean, all this happened because the dollar lost so much of its global purchasing power. But it continued to function as a reserve currency, as you know, but at a lower exchange rate. But what I think is going to happen is when the dollar can no longer function as a reserve currency, and it shouldn't even be now, but when the world abandons it, as they should, it's long overdue, then that's going to deprive the United States of a massive subsidy that we've been living beyond our means. But they're not going to go to the euro. They're not going to go to the yen. They're not going to go to the RMB. They're going to go back to gold,
right,
because that's where they were before. Right. I mean, in fact, the dollar never would have been the reserve currency. Nobody would have accepted the dollar as a reserve currency if it wasn't backed by gold.
Right.
It was
right,
the gold backing that made people think it could work. So we're going back. Gold's going to be remonetized.
Well, yeah.
And when it does, price is going to be much, much higher. You know, and meanwhile, too, look, gold bottomed out in December of 2015 at just above $1,000 an ounce. And at the time, everybody thought it was going to get killed, all the mainstream investors, because that's when the Fed started to raise rates.
Right.
And everybody said, oh, this is what's going to kill gold. Right now we're raising rates. But then, you know, gold's up almost 50% since then. But gold has been building a huge base. And people forget, you know, when people criticize me for recommending gold, I was telling people to buy gold in the late 1990s. It was under $300 an ounce. So gold went from 300 to 1900. That was a big move. Now, since 2011, we've pulled back. Over the last few years, we were consolidating. We now kind of broke out of that consolidation, and we're just ready for the next major leg up in the price of gold. But people forget, so far in this century, or this millennium, I guess, gold has outperformed the S&P.
Peter, I want to go back to something that you just said, because one of my listeners sent me a question. My brother, Andrew Plotnikov, writes, my question for Peter is, how would we orchestrate any type of return to the gold standard? Is gold the best commodity to peg currency to? And if so, like, how would we do that? What would that even look like, Peter?
Yeah, well, you know, countries have done that in a way, because what happens is, let's say you have a country that has a very weak currency. What they've been doing is then they peg it to the dollar, right? They find a way to control the currency and peg it to something of perceived value. That's what we would have to do. I mean, what the government would do is it would have to all of a sudden say, okay, each dollar is worth how many grams of gold, and just kind of say this, we're going to defend this level. And obviously, you know, the price of gold is going to have to be much, much higher than the current price to make the numbers work. Otherwise, you're going to have to see a huge collapse in the price of everything else, because you can either have the price of gold go way up, or you can have the price of everything else go way down to meet the price of gold. But most likely it'll be accomplished by a revaluation upward of the price of gold. But then what's going to happen is the government's going to have to live within its means. It's going to have to balance the budget, and it's going to have to defend the exchange rate between the dollar and gold. And then the government's going to have to, you know, cut spending, you know, raise taxes, whatever, so that because the Federal Reserve just can't keep creating money. But ultimately, the reason that the government would do that is, let's say the dollar is in free fall and where prices are just exploding and people have completely lost confidence, then how are you going to bring that confidence back? You know, I mean, one way you can try to do it is by raising interest rates, but that's not going to work because we can't afford to pay those higher interest rates. We got too much debt.
Right.
So, and really there's going to have to be some type of a default in realistic terms. You know, where the government says we're going to pay, you know, X cents on the dollar, because there's no way for the government to repay everything that it's obligated to pay. And I'm not just talking about the funded, $23 trillion of treasuries, but what about all the commitments to people on Social Security?
Sure, yeah.
Medicare and government pensions and guarantees to private pensions and guarantees to private bank accounts. I mean, the government is on the hook, I mean, for $100 trillion more of contingent liabilities. So it's impossible to pay these. Not with real money. Yeah, if we have hyperinflation, sure. You know, anything can be paid with worthless money. But to pay it back with money that still has some value, it just can't be done.
Yeah, and that's the default situation. It just seems like it's a foregone conclusion already. It's just a question of when. I have another listener that just, Lyle Engel, who just sent a question. He wants to know if you've ever done a segment on capitalism from 1860 to 1910. In the U.S., massive gain in standard of living for the average Joe, even with population tripling in a civil war, zero income or sales tax, government 3% of GDP, gold was money, wages more than doubling, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about that. It's called the Gilded Age, and you know, a lot of people look back at that as if it was like a problem, because you know, you had the robber barons, right? You had the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts and the Carnegies. You had these people that got really rich
and built the country,
paid no income taxes at all.
process.
Exactly. But what people overlook is the massive increase in living standards for ordinary Americans during that time period. I mean, they don't really have the statistics for GDP because they didn't keep them right back then. But you know, they have other statistics, other ways of measuring standard of living, you know. But I mean, the standard of living boomed like it's never boomed since during that period. I mean, mainly from the end of the Civil War to the beginning of the First World War, which really is the introduction of the income tax and the Federal Reserve, right, 1913. But but after the first income tax came in during the Civil War. That was the first time we had one. And actually, it was the first time we had paper money. It was an emergency wartime power. We had a Civil War income tax, and we had paper money. But then when the war was over, we got rid of the paper money, we got rid of the income tax, and we went back to a free country, and we boomed. And not only that, I mean, talk about immigrants. I mean, immigrants were pouring into the country during that period of time. I mean, massive immigration. I mean, way bigger than what we have today. Even if you added all the illegals coming in, it wasn't even a fraction of, you know, the people entering the country at that time, you know, certainly as a percentage of our overall population, right? We were absorbing all these immigrants. We were also migrating people from farms to factories. I mean, you know, back in 1865, I mean, almost everybody was a farmer. I mean, that was the number one occupation was farmer. You know, people had to be on farms.
Right.
But as the Industrial Revolution liberated farmers, because now you had machines that could do stuff. Well, we didn't. Everybody didn't need to work on a farm. They could do something else. So we had all these people, but we created the middle class, something that really didn't exist anywhere else in the world. It was an American invention, and you know, and I've even asked people to think about the world in 1865, and then think about the world in, you know, 1913. Right? Think about how people's lives were different in America, because in 1865. You know, no one had electricity. You had candles in your house.
Right.
You didn't have indoor plumbing. Right. You had an outhouse. You had a horse. Right. I mean, if you wanted to communicate with somebody, you had to send them a letter. You know. You know. You didn't have. I mean, you didn't have radio. You didn't have television. You didn't have any of this stuff. I mean, people in 1865 didn't live much different than they did in 1565. You know, I mean, there really wasn't much difference. But then you go to, 1915, and people have electricity, they have indoor plumbing, they have radio, they have there's air cars, airplanes are started. You have modern conveniences, you have modern appliances in the homes, you have refrigerator, stoves, you know, a lot of stuff that you know. That didn't exist. And now, you know, compare today to maybe 1950 to have a similar kind of time period. What's the difference? All right, we have cell phones. We have color TV instead of black and white. There's personal computers. But as far as the quality of living and the standard of living, I mean, for many cases, you would argue it's actually lower than it was in the 1950s.
Right.
Based on the fact that in 1950... if you were a married man, even if you didn't even graduate high school, you just had any job, you can afford your wife and support your family. Your wife didn't have to have a job, and you can raise four kids. You didn't need any credit cards. You know, you could save money. And today, you know, people are working two, three jobs. I mean, they can barely afford to have any kids, let alone four. When America did the best, when the incomes, the real incomes, rose the fastest, when the standard of living rose the fastest in America, was in that period, that Gilded Age. You know, when Donald Trump tweets about how the American economy is the strongest it's ever been, I mean, it isn't even close to what it was like during that period of time. And government was tiny. I mean, not only did we not have any federal income tax, no states had an income tax either. I mean, the taxes were tiny. They were an afterthought. People were free. People didn't even have to keep books and records. You know, isn't that, I mean, wouldn't life be great? I mean, imagine that, right? Imagine if you didn't even have to keep track of what you earned, right? There was nobody looking over your shoulders, you know, and you didn't have to do any kind of estate planning
right.
or gift tax because there was no estate tax, no inheritance tax. You just went out there. Right, you put all of your effort into making money, into building a business. Right, you don't have to worry about avoiding taxes or any of this. You don't have to keep track of what you earned. Can you imagine how much more productive we would be today if there was no IRS, no income tax, no estate tax, none of that? I mean, because we were able to accomplish all this stuff without having any of that government. You know, that's why America became the rich and powerful nation that it was, and that some people think it still is, but it's really not. But we did it because we hardly had any government. We had freedom. Freedom means no freedom from government. That's what it's about. Right? The government stays away. And it wasn't like we had people that were dying of hunger in the streets because there was no welfare and there were no food stamps and there was no minimum wage. You know, my grandparents came to America during that time period. Didn't speak any English, didn't have any money. They all were fine. there wasn't a single government program to help them.
Right.
And they did great. Coming here with nothing.
Peter, I have.
And it wasn't, they were, and it wasn't like my grandparents were special. They were like everybody else.
Right, right. Yeah, no, and they were all similarly situated, and it's just it's when you think about the difference between that and the way that we think about government policy and taxation and, you know, freedom now, it's just it's a black and white comparison, and it really makes you it makes you wonder. You know, the problem is that the government is too dumb to realize what you're saying, so they're not going to realize they can't raise taxes any further until they get beyond the point of no return. They're not going to realize that they can't lower rates any lower until they get past the point. They have to learn by being bludgeoned in the face, not, you know, from somebody explaining it articulately.
The government, I don't know if it's really the government that's too dumb. It's the electorate that's too dumb.
Well,
because the problem is they got look, politicians are going to give the people, unfortunately, what they want in terms of getting their votes. And so, you know, what gets people's votes is free stuff, promising
right.
something from government. You see, if you promise to just leave people alone, that's going to work well with a lot of people.
Right.
But not enough to win the election.
Right.
Most people don't understand how dangerous it is to put your confidence in government, right? To expect to get stuff from government. And so this is just a reflection of our system, which is why the framers, you know, set up America as a republic, not as a democracy, and they tried their best to insulate us from the evils of what they called mobocracy. And the reason that we were so successful for as long as we were is because people weren't voting for stuff. You know, we had a constitution that was enforced. Government was small. And so the economy became big. And we had big people like the Carnegies and the Rockefellers who used their wealth to benefit everybody else, the invisible hand, not only through innovation and creating products and
right.
services and providing employment, but they funded all sorts of charities. I mean, a massive amount of philanthropy took place during that time period.
Well, I've often said that, you know, the entitlement of all the things that we have now is not remembered and not considered, especially by people that advocate for socialism, especially younger people that don't realize the infrastructure. You know, say what you want about the economy now, fine, but the infrastructure that we have, the technology that we have, the freedoms that are afforded to us now, all of the standard of life that we have now is all a product of capitalism. It's all, or semi-close to capitalism.
Imagine.
But that's not even considered. People think that, you know, everything will stay the way that it is if we make this drastic shift.
I mean, the amazing thing is that capitalism is so good that even though we barely have it anymore, we have enough of it
right.
that we've been able to survive
right.
right, with all this government. I
right.
mean, could you imagine if we still had the government today, but we had the technology of the 1950s? I mean, the only reason we can afford all this government is because we have a lot of computers that make it possible, that make us more efficient. I mean, I
right.
used to joke, you know, if we had government today, like when the country first started, we never would have expanded beyond the 13 colonies. I mean, can you imagine, you know the guys that settled the West and that got in covered wagons and went out west? Can you imagine if they had to comply with government regulations, you know, they had like requirements, like safety requirements and standards.
Right.
What if they had to fill out tax returns along the way and, you know, pay? I mean, we wouldn't have gone anywhere as a country. It would have been impossible to have a country with all the government that we have today. Well, you know, now because we became rich without government, well, government got bigger, right? Because we were rich enough to afford it. But now they're impoverishing us, right? Government, you know, has grown like a cancer, and eventually, you know, a cancer consumes the host and kills it. And that's where we are. You know, that's why Trump was elected, because so many people felt the problems in the economy, and Trump was promising relief. He was
right.
promising to make America great again. And now he claims he's already done it. And a lot of people are going to say, this is it? This is what I voted for? This is great America again? I mean, I'm no better off than I was 4 years ago. In fact, I owe more money now than I did then.
Right.
You know, I'm even further behind in this rat race. So, you know, if this is as good as it gets, maybe I'll try socialism.
Yeah, and that's a bad scene. I have I got two last questions for you that I'm going to let you go. You've been generous with your time, and I appreciate it. I know I've been hounding you relentlessly to come back. So
yeah, we got a Christmas party tonight. So
oh, do you? Yeah. You going to be having a whiskey or what?
A what?
A whiskey.
Oh, well, I drink whiskey. I might, I drink a lot of old fashions here. I'm in Puerto Rico. This is our Christmas party for the community I live in. My office Christmas party is I'll be in New York City on next, I think, Tuesday for my office Christmas party, and we're going to be spending the holidays in the cold weather.
Lovely. Coming north for the winter.
Yes, the opposite of whatever. All the vacationers are coming down here, and I'm going back back north.
What's your whiskey preference for your old fashions? What type of whiskey? What do you have at home? What do you have at home?
For whiskey?
Yeah. What do you drink at home? What do you have at home? What kind of bottles do you have in your kitchen right now?
Well, I don't drink a lot. I mean, my wife drinks, Jack Daniels. My mom is here. She drinks a lot of vodka. She drinks a lot of a Grey Goose. But yeah, I don't sit around and drink a lot. I drink when I go out, but I'm not a big drinker.
All right, it's an interesting question. That's something I wonder. What does Peter Schiff have in his kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, we have wines. We have wines with dinner sometimes and stuff like that. But
all right, last two questions from on behalf of two of my listeners. And they both involve Euro-Pacific Capital. The first question is, when is your firm going to allow Canadians to invest with them from within their RSPs? And the second question is, why are your fees prohibitively high? Are they around 4.5%?
Fees for what?
I don't know what he's asking. He says mutual funds. Please ask Peter why his mutual funds are in U.S. dollars and why his fees are prohibitively high.
All right, so the first question on Canadians. So my company in Puerto Rico, which is Euro-Pacific Asset Management, has been pending with IROC, which is the regulatory body in Canada, for over a year. I mean, these guys have been putting us through the ringer. I mean, it's not just America that has a lot of regulations. I mean, Canada. So I am trying to get registered in Canada, and I'm there. I've filled out so much. I've done so much. I mean, any day I'm waiting and waiting. Hopefully, it will happen by January. I mean, I'm going up to a conference in Vancouver in January, and I really hope that we are registered in Vancouver by then. I mean, I can't make any promises, but once we are registered, then my funds will be registered, my asset management. I mean, people will be able to invest in those type of accounts directly with my a company in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
I will be a registered IROC firm operating out of Puerto Rico. And of course, we're also SEC registered, but we'll be a Canadian as well. So that is in the works. And I've been wanting to do that because I have a lot of Canadians who follow me. There are a lot of Canadians who have wanted to invest with me. And we really, based on government rules, we can take accounts from a lot of different countries without being registered. They have exemptions, but there is none for Canada. I mean, you got to be registered. If you want to work with Canadians, you got to be registered there. And so, we're really trying to make that happen. As far as the fees that you're talking about, that 4.5% fee only is the load on mutual funds, right? So I have various classes of funds. Some have loads and some have no load. And if you don't want to pay the load, buy a no load class, and then you won't pay the 4.5%. You'll pay nothing. So you just got to look around for the right share class, regarding which fund that you want to buy. And we have programs too where we waive the loads for wrap programs at Euro-Pacific Capital, where we manage people's portfolios in the funds. So I would say that in general, if you forget about the load, if you just look at the total fees that we charge in our mutual funds or our managed accounts, they're on the high side. I mean, they're definitely on the high side of what would be considered normal, but they're definitely on the high side of normal. They're not outside of the normal range. But the reason that they're higher than is typical is because the strategy is very atypical. I mean, if I was just offering a cookie cutter strategy, then I would have a lower fee because, but we're doing things that are very unique. We're investing in markets that most people ignore. And I'm investing with a game plan, with a goal of winning in the long run, right?
Right.
I'm not trying to impress people with short-term performance, because in the end, I believe that that's going to let people down. I think a lot of the managers, and this includes people with, you know, big hedge funds or, you know, people who are delivering returns that are beating the market, maybe because they're even more aggressive than the market and they're even more concentrated in even more overvalued stocks, right? I mean, the way to beat the market is just find the most expensive stocks and just go all in on them, right? I mean, they keep going up, right? But I think that when this thing turns, it's going to turn in a big, big way, and I think a lot of those profits are going to vanish. And, of course, you know, the managers keep collecting their fees. So if the profits vanish, they don't give back their fees. I mean, they keep that. And so I am trying to make sure that my clients are positioned to win all the money that other people are going to be losing, right? When everything that I know is going to happen eventually happens, right, and values are reset, U.S. stocks are marked down, the dollar is marked down, gold is marked up, foreign stocks are marked up, foreign currencies, and there's this big shift. Money is going to be, you know, purchasing power is going to leave the people who got it wrong, and it's going to, and the people who got it right are going to be rewarded. So I am investing for that to happen. So if, you know, if you believe that, that's going to happen, then my strategies are going to be great. I mean, if you don't believe that, if you think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with the U.S. economy and the U.S. market will just go up forever, and we could just keep on borrowing money forever, and there are no consequences, then, you know, my strategy is not for you. But if you think there is a day of reckoning coming, and you think it's, you know, coming in your lifetime, but, you know, in the meanwhile, we're still making returns. Like, I think our accounts are still up, you know, double digits this year, but not nearly as much as the S&P would be. Now, if you just look at our gold accounts, right, people that are just all in gold stocks, They're doing as well, but you know we've had a tough time with those gold stock accounts in years past, because gold, we went through a vicious bear market in the mining sector. But you know, if you're looking for stocks that can go up 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times, I think they're there. They're in the junior mining space, and it's going to take, you know, $5,000-$10,000 gold for that to happen. But I think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's just a matter of time. Do you have is there a publicly traded like Euro Pacific instrument on the U.S. markets? I know like some companies will have something that trades on the OTC that tracks like their funds.
No, you
like
know, the only thing that you can buy anywhere are my mutual funds, right? I have five mutual funds in the Euro Pacific family, and they're on Fidelity, they're on Schwab, and you know, so people can go and buy my mutual funds and just look up the tickers and buy them. And again, if you don't want to pay the load, just make sure you find the share class that doesn't have the load. In fact, if you're buying it at Schwab or Fidelity, it doesn't do me any good if you pay the load, because I don't get it. They do, so you get the no load.
Peter Schiff, thank you so much for your time, brother. Enjoy your holiday party tonight. Please have a cocktail for me, and let's catch up in the new year. Have a great holiday with your family.
All right, you too.
Appreciate you
so much.
All right, thank you. Bye. That was the one and only Peter Schiff. My man, my favorite economist, tells it like it is. Has no problem answering why his fees are so high, because he's doing some shit that other people aren't. And that's why I like him. One of my favorite bands, the Arrogant Sons of Bitches, had a lyric that said, "I do it because I like it, and I like it because you don't." And that's the fucking story at the QTR podcast. For now, I am out. Peace.